You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 29th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, how close are we to Israel's full-scale operation in Rafah?
If we're able to get this hostage deal in place, then that gives you 6 weeks of peace. It gives you no fighting for 6 weeks, and that includes no fighting in Rafah.
That's White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby. We'll have the latest from our correspondent in Jerusalem as pleas are made to the US to step in. Also ahead, we preview the Africa Heads of Summit, where governments and campaign groups call for more support to secure their future. But what will they achieve? Plus,
the thing about the catalogue was that it was the first time that products were shown in the context of the home that they would be in. And you had a sort of picture of the ideal home, as it were. And so this was quite unique at the time.
We hear from the son of the design giant Sir Terence Conran about growing up with the man who invented Habitat. And we find out why a major retailer in the UK is giving prospective employees their questions ahead of their job interviews. That's all coming up on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in today's news. Ukraine has warned that Russia is making gains in the east of the country as fighting intensifies. Two more international journalists have been arrested in Russia, and thousands of people have rallied for a second day in Madrid to call for the Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez to stay in office. Stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, Israel has warned Hamas that time is running out before it mounts a full-scale military operation in the southern Gazan city of Rafah. It has promised to carry out a major military operation unless the terrorist group accepts a deal on the table for the release of some but not all of the remaining 133 hostages. Before the 7th of October, Rafah was home to an estimated 275,000 people. This population has since ballooned by more than 3.5 times to more than 1 million by some estimates. Well, to tell us more, I'm joined now by Hannah McCarthy for the latest news coming out of Jerusalem. A very good morning to you, Hannah.
Good morning, Emma.
So we're now talking, from what we can gather, days as opposed to anything longer than that before this operation starts by the Israelis.
Well, this is the rhetoric we're hearing from the Israeli government. Again, what we're hearing, though, from the US is that they have not been provided with a plan that demonstrates how Israel would protect the humanitarian needs of the civilians in Rafah and evacuate them safely in the event of an operation. And in fact, what we've heard is references from various columnists, including Thomas Friedman, that it's possible if Israel went ahead with the Rafah operation without the support of the US administration, that could be the trigger for restrictions on sales to Israel. So again, what we're hearing is not a clear cut sign that the Rafah operation is going ahead. I think what's more likely is that this rhetoric around, you know, a Rafah operation being imminent is that it's designed to increase the pressure on the negotiations around the hostages and a possible short-term ceasefire that we're hearing.
Tell us about a little bit more about these talks. I mean, an Egyptian delegation was in Israel on Friday for talks with Israel on the possibility of a new deal and a ceasefire. But what exactly is being discussed and who's around the table and what are the possibilities of success?
Sure. So an Israeli delegation is expected to go to Cairo complete this round of talks. Again, what I'm going to say will sound familiar to many listeners because it's a kind of similar formula to what we've heard repeatedly over the last couple of months, the last hostage deal. So what we understand is on the table at the moment is that around 33 Israeli hostages who fit a kind of humanitarian category, they're young, they're old, they're sick, would be released in exchange for several hundred Palestinian prisoners, including those who have been convicted of serious crime, you know, for example, murder or attempted murder. And there would be a 6 week truce where there would be a cessation of all the fighting. And again, what we're hearing is the US are very keen on that plan. They've said that Israel should not be obliged to say it will give up its war. And again, what we know is that Hamas, one of the sticking points for them was that they want a permanent end to this war. They're very concerned that if they hand over hostages, their leverage, that there will be very little to hold back the Israeli military operation.
One of the issues that's emerged is that there are now divisions inside the governing coalition in Israel as to what to do next, because we have Benny Gantz, who's in the war cabinet, saying that the government would have no right to exist if it stops a hostage deal. But then you have the far-right finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, saying that such an agreement would be a humiliating surrender. This causes an extra layer of difficulty, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, these divisions haven't necessarily just emerged now. I mean, there's always been divisions within the Israeli cabinet. There has been a so-called unity cabinet since the start of the war. But I mean, Israeli policy making in relation to the war has always been fractured and confused because of the fact that there is these sharp divisions. At the same time, Benny Gantz has said that he is not opposed to a Rafah operation. He has also, you know, come out publicly against this idea for a Palestinian state. So he's not necessarily a moderate voice in this operation. At the same time, he's definitely put a lot more consideration on the hostages than we've seen from the more extremist elements of the Israeli government, who have simply said, you know, Israel should be willing to sacrifice these people in exchange for its security. But I think what we saw in Israel is that after there was two videos released by Hamas of American hostages being held in Gaza, that while their conditions looked poor, they looked sick, it actually rallied some of the families of the hostages where they were protesting in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. And I think there's a renewed vigour to get this hostage deal done.
And so, in fact, that those two videos that were released at the end of last week may actually have pushed Hamas's cause a bit further.
I think we obviously know that several of the hostages held in Gaza have died. Some of them have been rescued. So I think there were real concerns from families about who was actually alive and not. And even seeing loved ones in poor conditions, I think, was something of a message of hope that, you know, they were alive. And again, I think it you know, we've seen many speeches, for example, from Hirsch Goldberg's mother, Rachel, who has been a very vocal advocate for the families of the hostages. And we know Anthony Blinken as well is in the Middle East this week. So I think there is a renewed vigour to actually get this deal across the line.
Tell us a little bit more about the international position on this, because it's not long, it's a matter of hours since the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said that the only country that will stop Israel from conducting a full-scale operation in Rafah is the United States. How much is that true?
I think it's an accurate statement. And if Israel does not have the support of the US, or it faces a risk that the US would restrict arms sales, then it puts Israel in a very difficult position to continue that operation. At the same time, because it is, you know, facing, you know, Hezbollah in the north, and also again a possible future attack from Iran, you know, it's unlikely that the US is going to completely stop, you know, military support to Israel. That's unlikely, but it's certainly putting it in a more difficult position to continue a military operation without US support. And again, as I said at the beginning, Israel has not provided a credible plan to protect civilians in Rafah. And without doing so, they put themselves in a very difficult position in terms of waging a war that has virtually no international support.
Because this is a line, isn't it, that you mentioned, not being able to support a large-scale Israeli military operation in Rafah. This is something that the US has said repeatedly, and also the US President Joe Biden repeated it to the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a call over the weekend. But throughout this the 6-7 months of Israel-Hamas war, there has been very much the sense that Israel presses on regardless as to what the United States says. Is there a sense now that the United States' voice might not have the leverage that some might hope?
I think you're right that the Israeli government has pressed on in many cases against the advice that the US has given. At the same time, I think what has changed is certainly the more recent attack by Iran, where they sent over 300 missiles into Israel, towards Israeli airspace. That required active cooperation between many Israeli partners. Jordan was required to be involved. The UK, France and the US were involved. Israel cannot defend itself alone. And I think actually that attack has highlighted that it needs international support, and that if it is not getting this international support, it is making itself vulnerable. So I think that has changed the calculus slightly in a way that we didn't see maybe at the beginning of the war, where such a large scale attack by Iran was unthinkable.
What is Israel prepared to risk with this? I mean, you mentioned earlier on, you said the idea of we have, what, more than a million people funneled into this spot in Rafah, up to, close up to the Egyptian border. And the pleas to Israel to not conduct this operation are coming from every side. But if Israel were to do it, what do you think it would lose, and where would it lose out in the greater scheme of things?
I think many listeners might be aware that the ICC has been talking about bringing criminal charges against specific individuals in the Israeli cabinet. So the ICC is different to the ICJ case or court. It's a criminal court. It focuses on individuals. So this idea that individuals within the government could be held responsible, that's a real risk. And particularly if they go ahead with an Operation Rafah, where they told civilians to evacuate to, where they said this is a safe place, I think it puts individuals within the Israeli government, high level individuals, in a very difficult position in order to protect themselves. It does jeopardize the future of their military aid, and in terms of international support, it creates an incredibly difficult diplomatic position for Israel, that which is already isolated, and there's questions of whether it will be able to rehabilitate its reputation after the war, because we know that the US is now looking to the day after the war. Anthony Blinken is in Saudi Arabia talking about what that will look like, the reconstruction of Gaza while the war is still going on. So everyone is thinking, what will that look like if Rafah is invaded?
Hannah McCarthy, thank you so much for joining us on the line. You're listening to The Globalist live on Monocle Radio. (Music) 9:13 in Nairobi, 7:13 a.m. here in London. Now, Kenya plays host today to the World Bank and several African heads of state in order to establish priorities in funding for the next few years. Also high on the agenda is security. And to tell us more, I'm joined now by Tara O'Connor, who's founder and executive director of Africa Risk Consulting. That's a pan-African consulting company. A good morning to you, Tara.
Good morning.
So just explain to us what this summit is and what's on the agenda.
Well, really, it's the latest funding round. I think they're calling it IDA 21. So it's a 3-year funding round where it brings together the donors, the World Bank representatives and heads of state and their representatives of many African countries to try and define development objectives and for donors to agree the funding that will come around.
Just explain to us a little bit what IDA is.
So the IDA is the International Development Association. It's a World Bank institution that's been around since about 1960 and has objectives to reduce poverty through the provision of low and very low, zero or low interest loans and grants. And I think there are some 39 African countries that remain eligible for IDA funding.
Tell us a little bit more, therefore, about how they go about doing this in terms of the way that the meeting is structured and whose voices are heard.
So I think what the World Bank is really trying to do at the moment is to hear as many voices, not just from donors, but also from civil society, from all sorts of NGOs, to come together and actually determine what is essential for to get these countries, the main IDA IDA objective is to move these countries on from being very low income countries, very poor, earning per capita under $1,300 per head, to medium, you know, to low to middle income countries. In that's in World Bank sort of speak, if you like.
And it's stuff like bringing health, nutrition, even education and security protection programs into it. So, when we're having this meeting today, which are the leaders around the table that are going to be wanting a slice of this year?
Well, I think it's interesting that it is being led by William Ruto, and it remains to be seen who will actually turn up as heads of state. I don't know, for example, whether the new AES countries, the coup-led countries, the countries under military rule in West Africa will come, although they are eligible for IDA funding, whether they will actually have representatives here. But certainly, I think it's important that it's to note that it is happening in Kenya. It's happening on the continent. It's a very important conference that deals with continental issues that's being held on the continent. So we'll certainly see William Ruto, who has, you know, while he has courted the World Bank in order to manage Kenya's debt, he's also a driving force behind changing the way the World Bank actually agrees what sort of funding is necessary. And he wants the countries themselves, the client states, to have more of a say in how the money, more of a say rather than donors in how money is spent.
And how much do you think that the Kenyan President William Ruto's voice and suggestion that the countries who receive the aid are going to have more say? Because from the outside, it would make quite a lot of sense for that to happen.
Definitely. And it's part of this international drive. There is a real battle, an international, it's led by the global South country, the so-called global South countries that are raging against the dominance of the World Bank and the Bretton Woods institutions, as they're called, about determining how financing should be delivered. And this is also that amongst the criticisms, and it can't really be levelled at the IDA, which is a grants-based organisation, but a lot of the criticism that is levelled at the Bretton Woods, at World Bank and IMF, is that they don't do enough to reduce the cost of borrowing, cost of debt for African economies.
One of the things that it's still being addressed 4 years on is COVID and the fact that it threw national budgets globally. And there are enormous amounts of recovery going on right across the globe, but there are still pressing issues, aren't there, in certain areas of this region where inequalities have been deepened more than ever?
Absolutely. You know, the COVID, if we go back to the time before, if we think back to what was happening before COVID, Africa, the continent, sub-Saharan Africa, was the fastest growing continent outside of the Asian countries. It was setting average growth rates of between 5 and 7%. And all the dials were moving in the right direction, people moving out of poverty into middle class type status. And that was completely reversed by the shutting down of all these economies. And of course, the 39 countries that in last year in the 23 round got something like 25 billion from the IDA, the 39 of the poorest countries were worst affected, obviously.
Tell us a little bit more about the way that Africa and its population can solve this, given the fact that I think that there is an enormous amount of young workers that will be crucial to reshaping many, many countries' futures. How much is the young population being discussed here at this summit?
So, any discussion about Africa and Africa economics has to take the demographic into account. It's both its greatest challenge. If you consider that the average age of Africa is 19, in other countries, in somewhere like Uganda, for example, the average age is 16. And with vast improvements in primary healthcare, it is extraordinary that youth demographic is going to continue to increase. So any discussion of economics has to talk about both the opportunities that demographic presents, but also the challenges in an increasingly digitalized world where actual jobs are fewer. Something has to be done. And, you know, Kenya, for example, has addressed it rather effectively by focusing in the last 20 years on education, very, you know, improving education across the board. But other countries, primary education is obviously critical. Primary and secondary education is critical to actually make the most of that demographic.
Tara O'Connor, thank you so much, as ever, for joining us on Monocle Radio. Still to come on today's programme.
Sustainable just doesn't mean that the materials that they use and the manufacturing, the techniques they use are environmentally friendly, but you have products that will remain relevant both in terms of function and stylistically for their whole life.
We celebrate the 60th birthday of Habitat, the home furniture brand which brought Britain the duvet, and hear about plans to make the brand live for another six decades. Stay with us on The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Here in London. Let's continue with today's newspapers. And joining me in the studio is journalist and geopolitics specialist Atika Burke. Bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, you bounded into this room this morning.
Emma, I'm no longer freezing. What a glorious day.
It is. There is sunshine, ladies and gentlemen, outside, and Britain doesn't know what to do with itself.
Nor do I, evidently.
Here's an Australian who's completely befuddled by it. I think we've had enough of big coats. Let's have a look at the newspapers. We have this continued problem and this continued story of the issue of asylum seekers coming to the United Kingdom. And last week, the United Kingdom passed a bill that would send those who arrive illegally in the United Kingdom directly to Rwanda for processing. It's caused lots of problems domestically, but now other countries are piling in.
Yeah, this one is absolutely fascinating. Front page of the Times this morning, Ireland tied up in legal knots returning asylum seekers to the UK. Now, what Ireland says is happening is asylum seekers who fear they're about to be deported to Rwanda now that bill is passed are suddenly crossing from the Northern Irish border into the Republic of Ireland, which, of course, is in the European Union. And Ireland is very unhappy about this and, get your irony ding-dong out, wants to return them to the UK. So the UK is saying, no way, Jose, we will only accept returned asylum seekers when the European Union accepts us returning asylum seekers back over the channel to France. So we have the most circuitous roundabout merry-go-round happening here. A lot of this is quite perplexing, Emma, because if you were in fear of being deported to Rwanda, it means you came by a boat from France, i.e. Europe, originally. So why you would then have now ended back up in Ireland when every refugee advocate tells us that the proportion of asylum seekers who arrive into the UK is, by comparative estimates, very small compared to Europe, and they're getting here because they want to meet with family or something. This is all very, very strange. So Ireland is now trying to look at what emergency legislation it can introduce to return asylum seekers to the UK, but Rishi Sunak has said he'll have none of it. So it really does illustrate the ongoing issue of migration that plagues both Europe and the United Kingdom since Brexit, but also that actually, for all its condemnation of Britain, maybe a lot of other jurisdictions are looking at deportation to third countries or return agreements as ideal and have previously mocked Britain for wanting some of those arrangements.
Indeed, it's a funny tale, though, insofar as when the Rwanda bill passed last week, lots of journalists went to Calais to have a word with asylum seekers or illegal immigrants, saying, OK, if you once you have spent your however many hours it takes to cross the English Channel in a small boat, putting your lives tremendously at risk. I think five died last week, including a child. How worried are you that you will be scooped up and placed on a plane immediately to Rwanda? And every single one of them said, we're not. They said, we will get into the United Kingdom because the United Kingdom's system is more flexible. The culture is more arguably welcoming. But you don't need an identity card to get a job. You can work in the dark economy without a problem. And this sort of voice of determination seemed to sort of completely chime differently with everything that every politician is saying.
I think that's right. But also don't underestimate just the desire to escape from wherever you are. A couple of years ago, I was in Rwanda to cover CHOGM, the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, took a side trip to Gashora, which is a UNHCR and EU-backed asylum seeker processing centre that Rwanda houses. Now, there I met a refugee who was on his way to Canada. He had come from Eritrea and crossed via Libya. And I said to him, would you, this sort of scheme, would it make you reconsider if you were going to be deported to here to Rwanda to have your claim processed? And he said, no, I'd do it again in a heartbeat tomorrow. I'd pay all that money because here I am and Rwanda, you know, in many ways he did back Rwanda as somewhere where you could be processed safely because he said, now I'm on my way to Canada to begin my new life. So there is always that question about how much of a deterrent this deportation will have. We will only know the answer to that question, Emma, come July when the UK government is hoping the first of these flights takes off and maybe, just maybe, we'll be in an election campaign then.
They are hoping, I think, from as soon as today, actually, to start arresting people as they arrive, as the weather warms and the conditions on the English Channel improve. Right, Elon Musk flies in to meet China's premier. We've got Elon Musk. So we now have this battle of the private and public sector here, don't we? When we have giants of car manufacturing and Elon Musk's amazing influence over the world now, which is growing and growing and growing. And he's in China to try and work out how to take on the competition of the Chinese electric vehicle market.
Yeah, this is a fascinating story because Elon Musk reveals on his Twitter yesterday that he is, or sorry, X, that he is in China.
We're still doing that, aren't we?
I'm sorry. I apologise profoundly to Monocle listeners.
Everyone is still doing
One should not confuse their Twitter with their X's. Now, Musk has met Premier Li Qiang. And he is basically looking at sorting out an autonomous vehicle market, i.e. a robo-taxi, and perhaps launching that in China using artificial intelligence. Why this is interesting particularly, Emma, is because last week Musk postponed a visit to India, where he was supposedly going to be scouting a place for Tesla factories. Now, he has a Tesla factory in Shanghai, and here he has said this is his best performing Tesla factory, and he has gone to Beijing and Shanghai, and has been praised lavishly by Premier Li, who in a rare, emollient tone, according to the FT article, has said that the Tesla Chinese cooperation is an example of where American and Chinese private market can succeed together. So this is a very interesting geopolitical angle, I think, to what's happening here in a market sense, because Tesla is also suffering hugely. It has been overtaken by China's own BYD, which if you listen to some China hawks will say, well, BYD welcomed Tesla into China with open arms and took a look at that technology and went, maybe we can replicate that, a tactic that China does right across the board. And so now Tesla is at risk of being gobbled absolutely alive by cheaper BYD cars.
And here's this I think we can all remember, whether we can't remember, we've all read about the fact that one of the great problems of globalization was that enormous companies would go into China, this is in the early 90s, set up companies and not worry about the fact that people were looking and copying and improving upon. And
some might say stealing.
Well, yes, being inspired. And then finding themselves, and then the Chinese would find themselves not needing Western companies, and then it would become, and then it is becoming increasingly difficult. And one wonders the sense, or the common sense, about starting a Tesla factory in having a Tesla factory in China and wishing to integrate more.
Absolutely. And this is something that this is what seizes the entire Biden administration. And this is why you have the economic security first agenda, where they're trying to extract some of these technologies and factories back onto either friendly countries or, ideally, in America's case, onshore. Though you see that with green tech, you see that with the CHIPS Act. Tesla is a special case because Elon, of course, is a law unto himself. And he, by these comments, for as long as they last, you know, Musk does change his mind here and there. But this one looks, I think, to be a certain bet and a backing of continuing on in China.
Finally, there's an article in The Guardian today, which if you're trying to get into your many things with your many passwords, just watch out, because 12345 is no longer going to be, is no going to cut the mustard, is it?
This is so interesting, because who on earth would still set their passwords as 12345? Well, turns out, Emma, quite
loads
a lot
of people.
Yes, but this is not going to apply necessarily to you, we should be clear. What this is about, it's a new law that's coming in by a new measure that the Department for Science, Innovation and Technology in the UK is announcing today, that when you buy something, say maybe a home device, and the password's automatically set at 12345 or admin, which I have seen a fair bit, that is going to be banned, because they say that this is now just open slather for cyber criminals and cyber hacking. And so companies will not be allowed to use those basic passwords. They'll also have to publish contact details. How hard is it to get through to a tech company these days? Actually call someone on the phone. Well, these brands and things will now have to publish contact details, so that if you have a bargain and issue about security updates and things and the firmware upgrades that get rolled out, you can actually go and complain or get in touch with someone. So, I mean, that's a great move, I would think.
Well, it's another way to spend 20 minutes being frustrated with the internet. Take a book. Thank you so much for joining us in the studio. The time here in London is 7:33. A look now at the latest headlines. Ukraine has warned that Russia is making gains in the east of the country as fighting intensifies. Ukraine's top commander said Kyiv's outnumbered troops had fallen back to new positions west of three villages on the eastern front. Meanwhile, President Volodymyr Zelensky has issued a fresh plea to international partners to speed arms deliveries so that Kyiv can maintain its positions. Two more international journalists have been arrested in Russia. Sergei Karelin, who's a Russian and Israeli citizen, was detained on Friday. He's previously worked for the Associated Press. A day earlier, Konstantin Gabov was detained. He's worked with outlets including Reuters. Both men are accused of extremism in connection with alleged work for the late opposition leader Alexei Navalny's foundation, charges they deny. And thousands of people have rallied for a second day in Madrid to call for the Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez to stay in office. Mr. Sanchez said he's withdrawing from public duties for a while after a court opened an inquiry into corruption allegations into his wife. A decision on whether he will resign is expected later today. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. It's 7:34 here in London. Now it is nigh on 2 years since Sri Lanka declared itself bankrupt. The economy, however, is showing signs of stabilising. But with presidential elections on the way, how secure is the country's path to recovery? 2 weeks ago, the country rejected an international bondholder's proposal to restructure more than $12 billion of debt, putting at risk critical International Monetary Fund support. Well, to tell us more, I'm joined now by Dr. Ganesh Vignaraja, visiting senior fellow at ODI, leading UK think tank, and he joins me now in the studio. Welcome, Ganesh. I mean, you've written about this situation in a paper which is about to be published by the National University of Sri Lanka. But Before we, well, you might, I'm going to ask you what's in your paper in a minute, but tell us a little bit more. Take us back to 2022 and what went wrong.
So 2022 was probably the worst moment in Sri Lanka's economic history from an economic point of view. The country defaulted on its foreign debt of about $50 billion. There was some 20 million only in foreign reserves, which is a couple of hours of imports. And there followed a terrible economic crisis with inflation spiraling to 70% and poverty reaching some 5.8 million people. So that was really terrible. And this crisis was brought about by a combination of COVID hitting an economy that was already weak, reeling from a 30-year civil war, lots of public expenditure that was beyond what was possible, investment in infrastructure by China with low rates of economic return, particularly the famous Hambantota port, and then quite a bit of economic mismanagement by a previous regime headed by Gotabaya Rajapaksa. So this combination was quite toxic and the economy collapsed. But I think we are seeing this recovery that's coming now. But I think we're not yet out of the woods.
What's prompted this recovery? I mean, how have they managed to get themselves out of the woods?
So we had Gotabaya Rajapaksa resigning in 2022 and a new government coming in under President Ranil Wickremesinghe. And his government has been fairly decisive. They jacked up interest rates. They began to remove some of the subsidies, particularly on petroleum. And they went for an IMF bailout of $3 billion. And there was a lot of Indian aid. So it was a combination of international assistance and decisive action by Sri Lanka. And things have sort of improved. We're seeing inflation coming down to single digits. We are seeing reserves building up to about $3 billion. The exchange rate has appreciated to around 300 to a dollar. And there is the possibility of moderate growth because in 2022, the economy had negative growth of minus 7.8%. And today we are expecting in 2024 about 1.5% to 2%. So there's been a turnaround in some sense.
Tell us a little bit more about the path that, you know, the current situation that we're in. A couple of weeks ago, we have this rejection of a proposal to restructure a lot of debt. It then puts the IMF's support, which was considerable at the time, it puts that into doubt. So why are they playing around with it when it's working?
So what happens in these debt distress situations like Sri Lanka is that you have to balance the interests of what they call the official creditors. That includes China as well as India. And indeed, the UK has a very small tranche of export credits as well with these private bondholders. And the private bondholders basically are required to take a haircut on their debt, which means they take a discount. So if their debt was, say, $18 billion, this debt would hopefully go down to $9 billion. So that's the issue. So they lose money. And the proposals at the time were things like they would sign up to taking that hit, providing Sri Lanka grew, and then they would get an appreciation of what they would get in the long run. Or there was the proposal of a governance bond, that is, Sri Lanka implemented governance reforms, say, such as anti-corruption measures. Again, the bondholders would get a benefit from this, having taken a haircut in the deal. The problem is neither of these things were acceptable to them, so they basically left it for now. Why it matters is that the third tranche of the IMF money will be dependent to some extent on this. And this was sort of review in June coming up. And the IMF's good housekeeping approval for Sri Lanka is necessary for Sri Lanka to attract foreign investment, to attract confidence and to begin to grow. And this is where it is. So it's still tricky times, but much better than what it was during the bad days of 2022.
Briefly, Ganesh, how's life in daily Sri Lanka affected by all this?
So in daily terms, compared to 2022, there are no queues and shortages, which were a real problem. There were petrol queues stretching a couple of miles long, and people waited for hours and even days for petrol. Food was in short supply. Today, we can get petrol quite easily. The government have opened up the petroleum market, and now there's Sinopec, the Chinese producer that has come in, along with RM Parks from Holland, and there's also an American producer. So petrol is widely available. They've taken out the subsidies and made it equivalent to market prices. Food is available. One is able to import because the foreign exchange has gone up. But inflation is still quite high compared to the past, and people are struggling. So I think that's the political uncertainty we have. And elections are upcoming. And we'll have to see what happens in the future. But one is somewhat optimistic that things might turn around in the future.
Ganesh Vignaraja, thank you so much for that. You're listening to Monocle Radio. Now, today marks 60 years since the home furnishings shop Habitat opened its doors for the first time here in the UK. Founded and led by the retail and design titan Sir Terence Conran, it brought affordable design to Britain in 1964, a country hungry to sharpen its look. Well, thanks to Habitat, the UK embraced the flat pack furniture for the first time, as well as the duvet and the chicken brick. Last year, the final standalone Habitat showroom closed down, but the brand's name lives on, albeit only online or within a major supermarket chain. Well, to celebrate Habitat's birthday, the brand has released 60 products, some of them entirely new, others lifted or inspired by the archives. Well, I heard from Sir Terence's sons, Sebastian Conran, a lifelong employee of his father's firm and one of the designers of the current collection. Sebastian began by telling me what the brand Habitat means to him.
I think Habitat stands for design to me. I mean, I have a very strong emotional commitment to Habitat. I was present at the first opening, and you know, every Habitat catalogue launch was a big moment in the year for my family. My first job was, you know, working at Habitat. I'm the classic cobbler's son becomes a cobbler, and so I grew up with design in my blood. You know,
what was it like being part of the family in the run up to one of those launches, to when the catalogue came out? I mean, what was dinner around the table like in the evening?
Well. A lot of the time, the Habitat catalogues were filmed in our own home. So there was a lot of chaos and, you know, lighting rigs and all that sort of thing. And of course, in those days, pre-LED, this was really hot. And then, you know, you'd find transparencies all over the place. And it was a very energetic and lively and exciting time. And my dad was very hands-on and involved. But he also asked me, you know, what do you think of this? Or how do you think this should be? He was very inclusive. He sort of shared a lot of experience and insights with me at the time and with the rest of the family. So, yeah, it was, I don't know, Habitat was just my life. And it was sort of, I can't detach myself from it.
Sebastian, you've just led me over to a rather handsome lamp. Tell me about your collection here. What are we looking at?
Well, I'm slightly obsessed about how things work and how they're made. And so everything that I've designed in this Habitat lighting collection is driven by the characteristics of the materials I've used, the components I've used, and the effects that you can get out of them. And if you look at this ellipse light fitting here, it was sort of inspired by UFOs and flying saucers. But it was also inspired by chandeliers. And how chandeliers work is that they have very small light sources called candles, and then they have a facet or a lens, which is a crystal. So here I've got these horizontal lenses which take the teeny light sources and they focus it so that the light given off by the light source is reflected up into the ceiling.
What you've just mentioned there is a deep, deep commitment to technicality, to focus, and to going very, very, you know, granular in the way that you design items. How much do you think we see stuff like that on the high street nowadays?
Well, I think if you ask me what is a timeless design, it is one that takes a principle like this and uses it for the first time. And part of what we want to do is design sustainable products. And sustainable just doesn't mean the materials that they use and the manufacturing, the techniques they use are environmentally friendly. But you have products that will remain relevant both in terms of function and stylistically for their whole lives. And that is why we're aiming for timelessness in the design.
Tell us a little bit about when Habitat left the high street. When you walk into this room, you are surrounded by joyful, beautiful things, and I have a real longing when I see them to actually see them in a shop. How do you feel?
Well, my first ever job was in Tottenham Court Road, cash and wrap, and then stacking the shelves. I was probably about 14 or 15 years old, It is very sad that we don't have these physical stores that you have to schlep to on a Saturday, find somewhere to park, and then get your product in. But, you know, the world has actually sort of moved on quite a lot since then. But it is, you know, it's easy to be nostalgic about things, and it is very sad that the high streets are changing. But, you know, we're in a transition at the moment, and hopefully things will get better. The thing about the catalogue was that it was the first time that catalogues had been shown in with lifestyle imagery. I mean, my father hated this phrase, lifestyle. He was a style of life and or something. But the point is, products were shown in the context of the home that they would be in. And you had a sort of picture of the ideal home, as it were. And so this was quite unique at the time. And, you know, what was a catalogue has now become a website. And except that we don't throw them away at the end of the day. And that they can continuously be updated. And you see it there and it is available. It's not like back in the day where you would decide you wanted something. You would write out a cheque, put it in an envelope, send it off. They would receive it. They may have it in stock, in which case you might get it within 28 days. So from a customer experience point of view, from a rational and functional point of view, it's much, much better now.
And that was Sebastian Conran speaking to me ahead of Habitat's 60th anniversary. This is The Globalist on Monocle Radio. Time now for an update of the news in Asia, and who better to do that with? Monocle's Asia editor James Chambers joins us on the line now from Manila. A very good afternoon to you, James.
Good afternoon, Emma.
How are things in Manila?
Well, I left Bangkok this morning where it was a sweltering 38 degrees and landed in Manila, and it's about the same. So I've swapped one scorching city for another.
And what does that mean? How does Bangkok deal with it, and then how does Manila deal with the heat?
Well, I guess it's there's a story of inequality to all this heat in Bangkok in here in Manila. It is, you know, it's the height of summer. This is when it's hottest and driest, and a lot of the time for many of us, including myself, it's about complaining about being stuck in Arctic aircon for most of the day and trying to keep cool. But actually, for many other people, including in places in the Philippines, there is no aircon available, and so the government this week has had to take the decision to cancel or to shut schools and push kids to remote learning because it's just too hot. This extreme weather means that going to school to a lot of schools where they don't have air conditioning, it's just not possible.
Indeed. I mean, we're talking about 47,000 schools here, aren't we?
Yes, it's massive. This is nationwide. Of course, there are a lot of schools, especially in the capital here, where they will have some nice facilities. But this is a huge country, and there's a huge inequality here in the Philippines. And so for today and tomorrow, kids won't be going to school. They'll be going to remote learning. And obviously that will, you know, have an impact on their studies.
And did there are the issues that actually if you don't have air conditioning at home, it doesn't make it, you know, wherever you are, it doesn't really matter. It's just going to be hot. And so we have families saying, OK, we're actually going to take our children to the shopping centre because they have free air conditioning.
Yes, that's right. I mean, there's a big reason why there are so many shopping malls and shopping centres in these major cities in Southeast Asia. And it's because they act as more than just a retail destination. They are a community hub. They are a place to hang out. They're a place to get, you know, free lighting, free aircon. So you do see them full of people of all ages. And right now, yes, you will see, you know, families going there to cool down in this sweltering heat.
Let's move on to a continued geopolitical problem, which is the Chinese-Philippines issues over the South China Sea and China making claims to various patches of it or to large swathes of it. China has said that the two countries have reached an agreement over a dispute in the South China Sea. The Philippines actually dispute that.
Yes, it seems like an age-old dispute that goes away and then comes back when everything else in this part of the world is a bit quiet. But obviously the big shift has been the President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. being elected and changing tack from when President Duterte was in power. Duterte was far more Beijing-friendly, and Marcos has taken the Philippines back towards Washington and in a very big way. And the Philippines is now asserting, being much more assertive in its own rights to the South China Sea, especially in its own exclusive economic zone. And one of the key areas of contention is this Spratly Islands, where there's this World War II era Philippine Navy vessel that they sunk in 1999 as a kind of a tactic to assert their rights. Now, Beijing over the years has claimed many things about what the Philippines have said. They originally said that the Philippines had promised to remove this vessel, and it's still there 25 years later. And the latest thing they've said is that this has come out of the embassy, the Chinese embassy in Manila. They said that they reached an understanding, a new model with the Filipino government on how to handle this. And that was a couple of weeks ago. And then over the weekend, the defense minister for the Philippines came out and said, this is not true. We would never do that. This is just more Chinese propaganda. They're trying to, you know, sow kind of discontent in the Philippines. Don't believe any of it. They're just up to their old tricks.
Tell us more about the announcement that Nikkei Asia is going to end its print magazine. If you look at the press release, it says it is boosting its digital coverage, and then buried on paragraph four, it is, we are ending the weekly print edition. And just the context of this one, because it is one of the last few pan-Asian English print titles, isn't it? And it's going.
Yeah, so for people like myself, for many English speakers around Asia, you know, this was a bit of a business bible because it was a weekly print magazine that covered Asia like no other. All the other business weeklies or monthlies or dailies would normally, from the US or Europe. This was put out by Nikkei, which is the huge Japanese language media company, and this was their weekly English language publication. It was, you know, brought out in 2013, so it's not like it has an extremely long history. But you know, it's had over a decade of being printed and distributed all around Asia, and you would see it everywhere. And it was refreshing to read a publication that was, you know, Asia first. It would talk about Asia stories from an Asian perspective. So yes, it's very sad to see that the Nikkei have decided to pull the plug on the print issue. You know, as you mentioned, they are focusing on the website. But we'll see what kind of impact that has on the type of reach and readership it gets.
James Chambers, stay cool in Manila. Thank you so much for joining us. You're listening to The Globalist live on Monocle Radio.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Finally today, the British retailer John Lewis says job applicants will now be allowed to see the interview questions beforehand. It's in an effort to try to make the process a little fairer. Well, the department and supermarket chain has published questions for all job levels, but the firm's head of talent has said interviews will be no less rigorous, but that nerves can affect interview performance. Well, Simon Moonbrook is a journalist, a communications consultant, and someone I've actually seen someone train in interview technique, so I thought it might be quite a good idea to bring you in. Good morning, Simon.
Good morning.
I mean, this will make everybody who's ever felt the slightest twitch of nerves breathe a major sigh of relief, and everyone's applying to Waitrose. But what are your thoughts?
Well, I think it is. I mean, obviously, interviews are pretty terrifying, but they're not necessarily in a bad way if you can sort of harness those nerves, that adrenaline, if you like, and use it positively. Then I think it can work really well. I think it's a great idea in many ways. You know, it does create a level playing field because every candidate's going to have the same information. I think it shows that you're a kind organisation. Obviously, John Lewis very keen to promote themselves with their partnership model rather than just having employees being more sort of welcoming in that way. So I think that works well. And I was also thinking there's probably a gender element here, perhaps, because I do know that studies have shown that girls, for instance, at school tend to do better than boys in coursework, but then very often the male students outperform them in the actual exams itself. Boys seem to enjoy that, and the probably girls as well, who do enjoy the adrenaline, if you like, of being thrown into an exam situation. But there'll be many people, I think, who'd like the idea of a little bit more preparation.
I wonder whether you're being a little bit kind here, because at the end of the day, this is a company which specialises in dealing with people. If you're going to go into a supermarket, if you're going to go into a shop, we have all been into shops where there are people who probably are maybe in the wrong place because their interpersonal skills aren't quite up to it. And if you can't think on your feet for an interview, how on earth can you think on your feet when dealing with a customer?
Yeah, well, presumably John Lewis would say that was their training. But yeah, no, I think there are downsides to this model as well. I mean, one thing I was thinking is, if everybody has the same information, everybody is probably going to think of the same kind of answer, aren't they? So there's more of a challenge here to stand out, to differentiate yourself, to be a little bit more creative. You need to be a little bit more creative, I think. That's a problem that you're going to have to think about. There's also, of course, the fact, as I say, that everybody might be saying the same thing. You're going to get these rehearsed model answers.
Well, might even get it written by ChatGPT or your mate.
Absolutely, which could make things up, couldn't it? But there's also the risk, I suppose, that some candidates are going to get extra help. If you're in the room there and it's just you and the interviewer, there's just the two of you. But if you've got your dad, for instance, as a managing director who's employed thousands of people, interviewed goodness knows how many people, then he or she is, you know, going to be able to give you a bit of help, aren't they?
What about the non-verbal communication bit about this one? And the words and what you've rehearsed are only one part of it, isn't it? I mean, actually, the majority of the reaction that one person has with another person is, you know, how do you look? How do you come across? The basic stuff, back to the Neolithic stuff. Are you going to eat me? Are you more powerful than me? Or, you know, could I even work with you? And that's the stuff that you can't rehearse for, or is it?
Well, I think you can practice. You can plan, can't you? You've got to think carefully about what you're going to wear. I mean, I wouldn't recommend wearing kind of John Lewis colours. That's probably a bit crawly, perhaps. But thinking about something that, I mean, basically what we like in people is we like authority and humanity, don't we? Like you say, we want somebody who knows what they're talking about, who inspires confidence but still is a nice person. So I think thinking about what you're going to wear to make sure that you create that impression is very important. And the other thing I say to people when I'm training them to do media interviews or presentations, three simple words: pause, breathe, smile. So I think if you're a young person, especially sitting down in that chair, terrified probably, going to be interviewed by a group of people, just taking that moment to pause before an answer, before saying hello, breathe, that gives you confidence, helps you relax. And smile will also give you confidence and help you relax. And it'll also signal that you're a nice person who's happy to be there.
Briefly, we've got about 10 seconds. Would you hire someone who knew all the answers because they'd prep for it?
That's really difficult. My head says, yes, I would, because they would be really great and do their job very well. My heart says, well, I think they sound a bit scary, actually, so I'm not so sure.
Simon Brook, thank you as ever for joining us in the studio. And that's all the time we have for today's programme. The warmest of thanks to all my guests and to the producers, Laura Kramer, Carlotta Ribello and Monica Lillis. Our researcher was George Ruskin and our studio manager, Mariella Bevan, with editing assistance from Lily Austin and Flynn Simons. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. The Briefing is live at midday here in London, and the Globe List is back at the same time tomorrow. I hope you can join me for that if you can. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening and have a great week.